This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford. And on this week's episode, we'll be hearing from Janet Foy, who was recently appointed the five-star status as an FEI dressage judge. We'll also be hearing from the USDF GMO coordinator, Maggie Schell, who will be here to explain the different types of memberships for you and your horse as you prepare for the competition season. And finally, in our education segment, Dr. Hilary Clayton will be here to begin a new series on rider biomechanics. But first, we would like to remind you that the views of guests and the hosts of this podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of the USDF or its members. And before we hear from Janet, we have one item of news for you. The USDF has selected the dates and locations for the 2018 Great American Insurance Group USDF Regional Dressage Championships presented by SmartPack. These championships recognize the outstanding efforts of riders in each USDF region and provide an excellent opportunity for spectators to view the top competitors in their respective regions. Additionally, the top amateur and open riders at each of the championships who have submitted a declaration of intent and completed all other requirements will receive an invitation to compete at the USDF Dressage Finals presented by Adequan. For a complete list of dates and locations for both the 2017 and 2018 regional championships, click the competition button on the homepage of the USDF website at usdf.org. And our first guest this week is Janet Foy, who is an L program faculty member, an FEI dressage technical delegate, and FEI four-star young horse judge. In addition, Janet is also a USDF senior dressage judge and registered dressage sport horse breeding judge. And she joins me now to give us her reaction to her recent promotion to become an FEI five-star judge. First of all, welcome back to the program, Janet.
Thank you. Always enjoy being here.
And congratulations.
Yes, I'm thrilled and excited and a little bit nervous and a little bit overwhelmed as well. It's a big responsibility.
It is. And also, it's quite prestigious when you think of it. You're only one of four five-star FEI judges in the US, the others being Linda Zahn, Ann Gribbons, and Gary Rockwell, correct? So it's a small and elite group. In terms of your career as a judge, Janet, what does that mean to you?
Well, at this point now, I'm able to judge Olympics and World Equestrian Games. Four stars are allowed there's one four-star allowed on a World Cup panel. There is one four-star allowed on a Pan American Games panel, that sort of thing. So really, it's only now being able to judge the really elite competitions of the Olympics and the World Equestrian Games. And then the other piece is there's a five-star meeting every year where all the five-stars get together and basically discuss the future of the sport and talk about scoring and which movements are giving problems. Should they change some of the rules in the freestyle, etc. So I'm looking forward to that because I hear that's a highly educational and interesting meeting, and that usually takes place in January. The other thing five stars are able to do is to mentor and shadow judge with up-and-coming candidates from different countries that are working their way up the ladder from two-star to three-star to four-star. So I'm looking forward to all those things because I enjoy the education, and certainly judging at the Olympics would be a huge thrill, and judging at the World Equestrian Games would be a huge thrill, although I'm not sure who would be more nervous, the judges or the riders. Anyway, you know, it is an awesome task and an awesome job, but I'm looking forward to it. I think it will be great.
A new challenge, of course, moving up to them. Well, let's set this and contextualize this, Janet. In terms of the grading system that there is within the FEI, you come up through your national federation and the progression, the kind of timeline. So we'd have to go back to where you began then as a USEF judge. and that career, right, and where it started and how long it's taken you at the different levels to reach this.
Okay, well, let's see. It's changed a little bit because when I started, we did not have the L program. And if you were starting today, you would have to first go through the L program. And all of these different levels have different requirements as far as riding. Your riding skills have to, you have to move up the levels and have a certain number of scores over 60% to even apply, because we definitely want judges who have ridden at the level they'll be judging. But back in the 70s, when I started, they only had small R and large R judges. So there was a group of 10. There were only 9, actually. I was the 10th that got talked into it. I didn't really want to be a judge because I was training and competing, but they needed one more. So I got talked into it, and we had 3 weekends. We had Vi Hopkins and Colonel Moeller and Mike Matthews. And then we had an exam, and none of this was at a horse show. It was all classroom and demo horses. And even the exam was demo horses. And there I go. I passed. And so now I'm a small R judge. And at that point, I could judge through 4th level. And the large R's then could judge through Grand Prix. And after I'd been there for a couple of years, they switched it and made small R, large R. And then they called it I for international. That became confusing with the FEI, and they changed the I to S, the senior judge, which is the way the U.S. system stands now. So at that point, I had to go and take another program, an exam for my large R, which I did at Pebble Beach, and I passed. But interestingly enough, at that time, I also had a horses there showing, and so I did the judge's exam and showed at the same show, which is never, would never be allowed nowadays. And then for quite a while, I stayed a large R because I was at several Grand Prix horses and I was really more interested in showing. Back then, you had to stay at your current status for 3 years and judge a certain number of shows before you could apply for promotion. So I had that, but I just wasn't interested at the time. So finally, I did my senior judge program and passed that. And that was in the early 90s. And then my friend Lois Yukon said, "We need to be FEI judges." And I said, "What is that?" And she goes, "Haven't you shown at CDIs?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, those are FEI judges." And well, I didn't know. I thought they just were foreigners, you know. So she filled me in on that and drugged me along. And we had to be senior judges then for 3 years and have a certain amount of panel judging, as well as the Grand Prix riding scores. And we were then approved by our federation, and we went into a program and apprentice judging. And then we became what they called at that time C or candidate judges. We stayed there, both Lois and I, for about 5 years. Now it's 3 years, usually. And we were then promoted to 4-star. 4-star back then was called I or international. And then the 5-star, which used to be called O, there's not really a program or an application. Right now, the JSP, the Judges Supervisory Panel, the other 5-stars, and the FEI Dressage Committee identify up-and-coming judges. They look at the need of how many countries are represented, because on the championship panels, you can only have one judge from each country. So we need some exotic countries as well. And they identify those judges. And then you're invited to become a 5-star. There's not really an exam. You do have to judge quite a lot of Grand Prix around the world. And I've been very lucky to judge in Europe and a lot of countries around the world. So anyway, I feel very fortunate and very lucky and very blessed to do it. And I would say, let's see, if I started in 1977 and it's now 2017, that's a pretty long, long time. I didn't do it the quickest way possible, but I started young.
What inspired you then, Janet, in the first place to have a go at judging, think that this could be something for you, as well as, you know, in addition to your riding career? Of course, it was going to be time consuming if you were going to go through that education, which it demands to go through every step of the way. So you must have been ambitious, were you, at that point to go in that direction. But what was the original inspiration, or was it one person?
Well, there wasn't an original inspiration, except all my friends said, if you don't join this program, we can't have it. So I didn't really want to be a judge. And then when I became a judge, I guess I'm a bit of an overachiever. I thought, well, if I am a judge, I better darn well get good at it. And I didn't feel very good or competent. I did work very hard, and I tried to do all the education I could. And I always attend more judges' forums than are required. And I went with the USDF, used to take judges' trips to a Europe with a group of judges, and I always went on those. So I worked hard. It wasn't something that, one day I woke up and said, I dream about being a FEI dressage judge. I don't think anybody ever does that. We all love horses and we all want to ride. And then I think at some point you realize that your body's giving out and you know that the team is never going to happen for you. And you find a different way to sort of serve the sport at the international level other than riding. So it's an elite group that represents the country, and it's an elite group that gets to judge those top events as well.
So how many shows would you judge at then in any one year, Janet? Does it fluctuate drastically now, or is it stabilized now you're established as a judge, and especially at this level? And that obviously involves a great deal of traveling. But give us a picture of how much that involves domestically and internationally now for you.
Well, I have to say I don't accept all the invitations I get to judge. I probably do 12 to 15 shows a year and 4 or 5 times out of the country. And that's all. Otherwise, I'm too tired. I do a lot of clinics. I love teaching. I love working with the horses. I also do usually 3 or 4 judge training programs or exams or judges forums. Again, I really, really enjoy the teaching aspect and love teaching. I mean, that's probably my passion, if the truth were known. So I have sort of a reverse job. I'm home during the week. I'm gone almost every weekend. We do go to Florida January, February, and March, and I try not to fly out of, I try not to fly at all. I try to just do things that I can drive to in Florida. So I have a little bit of a 3-month sabbatical. I did have to go to Europe in January, but, one trip was not so bad. The rest of the time I kind of enjoyed it. And then I come home and become a road warrior again and have to remember how to pack my suitcase, and forgot my toothbrush the first trip out, things like that. Got to get back in practice.
Right. Well, I'm curious now that you reflect on the career that you've had, as you said, goes right back to the mid-70s, what those career highlights might be for you. What were the ones that have stood out for you along the way?
Oh, gosh. Well, I have to say the first time I was invited to judge at Gladstone was really exciting and very huge. The first time I was invited to judge in Hickstead, England was very exciting. I love judging in France. I also had a wonderful time. Wojciech invited me to come judge in Poland. I thought that was amazing. I love judging in Korea and also Peru. Going to those places, it gives you a great time to have a few extra days and take a vacation and really see the country. So I've been really blessed to see the world and have my airfare paid for. So, and my husband loves to come along to the more exotic places. And I have to say, I'm really looking forward to going to Russia. I've been to Belarus once, but my colleagues tell me that the shows in Moscow are just amazing. So, and I hope at some point now I'll be able to judge Aachen. I think that's a huge dream of mine. And then I also just love Olympia. I've been there many times for a judges forum, but have not been able to judge there yet. So those are some of the things I'm looking forward to. You know, just continuing. I've got such a great group of friends and a great group of colleagues. It's a little family, and we see each other sometimes two or three times a year, but it's it really is amazing, the group of people and how close you get to them.
So if Frank Kemperman is listening, Janet has declared her interest in judging at Aachen.
There you go. He said, yes, Janet and every other judge in the world. But, yeah, I mean, what an amazing show, you know, just an amazing show. So anyway, I think there's so much to see in the world, and I'm really looking forward to going, you know, through some of the Scandinavian countries. And I haven't been there since the late 60s. And so I think there's a lot of doors that are going to be opening, and I'm just, you know, excited to see what's behind them.
And of course, on the bucket list, as you said, is the Olympic Games and the World Equestrian Games. So I think the message is clear.
Yes, Chris. Right? Yes. I know. Let's hope. And then I'll need some calming massage therapy, I'm sure.
Do you get nervous?
Oh, I think everybody gets nervous. I don't think anybody sits down, even Stephen Clark, who's even Gary, who's done three Olympics. When you sit down at a big event like that, you are nervous because you want to do the very best you can. And it's not that you're doubting yourself, but it's just that, oh my gosh, this is really exciting. Here are all these wonderful horses. Oh, please, I want to do the best job I can. And I think at the end of the day, we all try to do the best job we can. And you know, sure, sometimes we make mistakes. And out of one day judging Grand Prix, you're going to be giving almost 4,000 marks. If you can get 4,000 scores and be perfect, well, then you should apply to be an FEI judge because, you know, it's tough. It's tough to concentrate for 8 hours a day. The riders concentrate for their warm up and their ride, you know, and we're there the entire time for everybody. So, we get nervous, and I'm sure the riders don't even realize that, but it's mostly because we really, you know, we're really there and we're really for the riders and wanting to do the best job we can.
And of course, there are always those challenges to the rules as well, and those quirky moments like happened to Ulla Salzgeber and Rusty in Sydney, if you remember, and, you know, the times when the music stops or something bizarre happens as well, and you have to call on all your education and knowledge of the rules to work it out. But you do have that team around you. You're not the only judge, so you do have a reference and your team to consult
with. Exactly, exactly. Yeah, I don't think sitting at sea is anybody's dream because it puts a lot more stress on you.
But it sounds like you're up for the challenge. And once again, congratulations, Janet, on becoming a 5-star judge, and the very best of luck with the rest of your judging career.
Thank you so much, Chris. Lovely talking to you and to your audience.
And now in our Inside USDF segment, the GMO coordinator Maggie Shell is here to explain the different types of memberships that you and your horse need for the competition season.
I'm happy to be here today to talk to you about membership and horse registration requirements. First, we're going to talk about the people requirements. The first type of membership that we have is a group membership. So that's going to be through your local group membership organization. There's a listing of those on our website, which you can go and check out to try and find a group that's close to you. We definitely encourage everyone to be involved at the local level with their group membership organizations. With USDF, when you have a group membership, you can compete at recognized competitions without paying a non-member fee, and you're also eligible for scores to count towards rider awards, which are your USDF gold, silver, bronze medals. That's a really good option for a lot of people, and there are also individual benefits with the different groups. The next type of membership is a participating membership, which can be renewed online, or you can fax or mail a paper application into us. The participating membership is directly with USDF. A participating membership is effective the day you submit the application and membership fee, and that it expires on November 30th of the current year. Assuming all other memberships and horse registration requirements are met, you're eligible for everything with USDF when you have your participating membership. That includes year-end awards, you know, like the All Breeds Awards, and you're eligible to qualify for championship programs like regionals. If you're using the online option to get your participating membership, I would definitely make sure to save the last page of the transaction screen. It will say this is your temporary verification. If you're doing this right before a show, you can take that to the show secretary and use it as a verification. And next, we're going to talk about horse requirements. Horses can also be registered online, or you can fax and mail in the paper application that's available on our website. The first type of horse registration is the horse identification number, which we call the HID. An HID is the minimum requirement for your horse to compete at USDF recognized competitions so that scores earned will be recorded. The HID is only a one-time fee and it does not need to be renewed. The second type of horse registration is a lifetime horse registration. It's the highest level of registration for a horse with USDF. Again, it's only a one-time fee. It does not need to be renewed. With the lifetime horse registration, the horse is eligible for basically everything with USDF, the year-end awards, regional championships, and that kind of thing. Keep in mind that for scores to be counted for these things, the horse must also be owned by a USDF participating or active business member, and the rider of the horse must be a participating member. If your horse already has an HID registration, you can upgrade that registration to a lifetime registration at any time. This can also be done online. If you upgrade the horse from an HID to a lifetime registration, the horse will keep the same number, but the type of registration will be changed. Keep in mind that when you upgrade a horse, it's not retroactive. The horse must be upgraded to lifetime status prior to entering the ring in order for scores to count for awards and championship programs. Just a few tips for registering your horse with USDF. If you're registering with both USEF and USDF, make sure that the horse's name matches exactly between the two. Once again, like with your membership, if you are registering a horse online, make sure to save that last page of the transaction, as that can be used as temporary verification. If you submit a horse application online, keep in mind that you're going to get a number for the horse by email the following business day. If you're sending in breed papers, you can fax or mail them to us after you have the horse's number. You will be able to print a card or ID for the horse from our website within 2 business days of submitting an online application, or within 2 business days of us receiving your paper application in the office. We usually mail out official certificates within a week or two of your horse's registration. Now we're going to talk about horse transfers, which we get a lot of questions about. If you think your horse may already be registered with USDF, make sure and try and check on our website or give us a call so we can do a search. We do our best to never duplicate horse registrations. So if it comes up in our system that your horse is already registered, we will be contacting you about a transfer. That way we don't assign the horse a brand new number. In addition to the transfer fee, we will need the signature of the owner that we have on record for the horse in our system. We can't accept the signature of agents or family members, even if the owner we have on record is a minor. We'll need that signature on the back of the original certificate where a transfer form is printed, or we can have the signature on a bill of sale that will be submitted along with our transfer of ownership form. If you don't have the signature of the person that we have as owner in our system, you can submit a transfer form with a copy of the horse's breed registry papers if those papers have been fully transferred into your name. Unfortunately, we can't accept breed papers that are in the process of being transferred with the registry. Lastly, and perhaps easiest of all, you can submit a transfer form too. This needs no other documentation, but your signature needs to be notarized. In closing, there is more detailed information about all of this on our website, usdf.org. You can go to the membership tab and see where everything's broken down. You're also always welcome to give us a call with questions or concerns.
And finally, in our education segment, we have the first part of a series on rider biomechanics that was recorded at the 2016 Adequan USDF Annual Convention. In this episode, Dr. Hilary Clayton, who is a full-time researcher, talks about rider conformation.
So when we think about how the rider is going to affect the horse, there are two really main avenues by which the rider affects the horse. We call these the inertial effect and the behavioral effect. So the inertial effects are simply due to the rider's weight and rider's movements acting on the horse's body. So these inertial effects would maybe change the horse's movements in response to a shift in the rider's weight, or it might change the horse's energy expenditure just because they're actually carrying more weight. The changes that are maybe more interesting to us are the behavioral effects, and these are the learned effects of the horse. So we train the horse to have a certain muscular response when we put on a specific aid. And our goal is to be able to use a very light aid to obtain a large muscular response from the horse. Okay, so two different ways that the rider can affect the horse's performance. Now, whenever we put weight on the horse's back, the horse's energy expenditure is going to change. The horse is going to have to use more energy to get from point A to point B at a certain speed. And research has shown that it doesn't really make any difference whether it's a live weight or a dead weight. The amount of energy expended by the horse to carry an extra amount of weight is the same. But what makes it more difficult for the horse is if that weight is moving around. So it's a lot easier for a horse to carry a weight that's still and very predictable than it is to carry a weight that's moving, sort of swaying around unpredictably. Horses hate unpredictability. So how does carrying weight actually affect the horse? Well, it increases the length of time that the legs are on the ground, because the horse needs to generate more propulsion, so he keeps the legs on the ground a little bit longer. That is something, though, to think about in terms of dressage performance, because what we want is a horse that's able to spring off the ground quickly, have a lot of air time, and only a little ground contact time. Right, that's the horse that looks really springy and bouncy and gets himself off the ground. So if the horse is carrying a heavier rider, he's going to look a little bit more earthbound. The other things that increase when the horse is carrying either a white rider or dead weight, it'll work at a higher heart rate and will produce more lactic acid, so he's going to get tired sooner when he's carrying more weight. But those are not really particularly important in dressage. It might be more relevant if we were talking about endurance horses or event horses. Like I said, horses like consistency and predictability. When we think about the rider position, we're always taught, right from square one, that when we look at the rider from the side, we want to see the ear, shoulder, hip, and ankle in a vertical alignment. And then usually as a caveat to that, people will say the rider should look as if the horse disappeared from underneath her, she would land on her feet and be perfectly balanced. And it always seemed to me that was a really strange thing to say, because the likelihood of the horse just disappearing, you know, is pretty slim. But why would we want the rider in this particular alignment? Well, the answer is that this is good posture for the rider. And what we can define as good posture is that it actually minimizes the rider's effort in supporting her body. Okay, so good posture is energetically efficient. And in this good posture, it's not just that the ear is aligned with the shoulder, the hip, and the ankle, but in this position, the vertebrae are aligned in the correct alignment. By having this correct alignment with the vertebrae stacked on top of each other, the head stacked on top of the body, that is a position that minimizes the effort the rider has to use. And we all like to minimize effort. That's always a good thing. But it also helps to absorb shock. Now, the shock is coming from the movement of the horse. The horse's movement is transmitted through our seat to our body, and we need to have good shock absorbers so that we can absorb that shock before it gets up to our head and starts scrambling our brains. And the correct posture also makes it easier for the rider to apply the aids correctly. So we talk a lot about the way that the vertebrae are stacked on top of each other. The vertebrae are not actually in vertical alignment. There are some gentle curves to the position of the vertebral bodies. And typically, there is an inward curve at the neck, an outward curve at the shoulders, an inward curve in the low back, and then the tailbone is a little bit sort of tucked under, so we've got another outward curve there. Horses also show some curvatures in their spine. Typically, they have like an S-shaped curve in the neck. So just behind the pole, there's a curve that would be concave on its underside. And then we go down the neck to where the vertebral column turns and goes into the back. And there we have a curve that's concave on its upper side. Now, through the horse's back, if we look at the position of the bodies of the vertebrae, then there's actually very little curvature. The bodies are in a fairly straight alignment. The curvature that we see is due to the top of the spines of the vertebrae. So a very long spinous process is in the withers region. And as these spines decrease in height, as we get to the back of the withers and going along the horse's back, we see an apparent curvature. But that is not the same thing as the curves that we see in the human spine. People vary in their conformation, just like horses vary in their conformation. And some people have more curvature in their lower back than others. And they talk about that as being hollow back, sway back. The technical term would be a spinal lordosis. It just means a hollow back. Now, although horses normally have a fairly straight, fairly horizontal line for the bodies of their vertebrae, some horses also develop a hollow back, and then the bodies of the vertebrae have this curved sort of shape. Sway back is the term we use a lot in horses, and if you want to put in technical terms, you'd say that horse has a thoracic lordosis. Horses sometimes also have the opposite thing, a little bit further back in the lumbar region. They sometimes have a curvature in the opposite direction that's called a kyphosis. So this would be a round back or a humpback. I think humpback is probably a better term in people, where if they have a kyphosis, it's up in the shoulder region, a typical sort of humpback. In horses, this is sometimes congenital. They're sometimes born with it, and it can develop most often in horses with stifle problems, stifle pain. So why do we have these curves in our spine? When a baby is born, these curves are not present. The whole spine is like a C shape. And then as the baby starts to support his head and neck, he develops this curve at the top, at the neck. So the curve is developing in response to the muscles getting stronger. It's the muscle development and strengthening that actually causes the curves to develop. And then a few months later, as the baby starts to walk around, then the muscles in the lower body are getting stronger, and that's when they develop the curve in the mid to low back. So these curves are both caused by and maintained by the tension in muscles, ligaments, and tendons that are connected to the vertebrae. We talk about neutral spine or correct alignment of the spine, and that's important because in that alignment, these curvatures are actually helping to cushion the spine and also to stabilize it during various types of activity, athletic performance, and helping to distribute the load along the length of the spine. So the curvatures do actually have an important function. So we don't want to get rid of these curvatures and actually align the vertebrae vertically above each other.
And our thanks to Dr. Hilary Clayton for this continuing series on rider biomechanics. And finally, a reminder that if you're looking to verify your competition scores, USDFscores.com is the official USDF source for the most accurate and complete dressage scores. Current USDF group, participating and business members can verify scores for vintage cup and adult amateur status, can also review the Great American USDF Regional Championship scores, check the progress towards earning a bronze, silver, or gold medal, verify enrollment of a horse into the All Breeds Awards program, as well as their score prerequisite for entering part two of the L Education program or to test for instructor certification, And finally, the new 2017 Freestyle Riders can use verification from usdfscores.com to confirm their eligibility to ride in a freestyle class with competition management. And that's it for this week's episode. As always, you can download this podcast from the iTunes podcast store to any podcast app. You can also find out when the latest episode of the USDF official podcast is live by following us on social media, on Facebook and Twitter. And for educational resources and information, please go to eTrack on the website at usdf.org. Until the next time, thank you for listening wherever you are in the world. And remember, the USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.